Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome on this Earth Day. We are about to have a conversation with Tom Horton, who's a longtime environmental reporter with The Sun, written numerous books on Chesapeake Bay, and many, many things over the years we've done together. He's done on this program. This is both an Earth Day show and one of our Urbanite radio stories for the piece he wrote in The Urbanite and this month's Urbanite. And Tom Horton, good to see you.
Good to be here, Mark.
So, here we go. I always wanted to find a way to have kind of an uplifting story for Earth Day. It's hard to do.
Well, you have to work at it, yeah. But we need to work at that. It's too easy to just bash people into the ground with all the things.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I deal with my students at Salisbury University. You know, one young woman said, "Well, when I signed up for environmental science, I knew I would be depressed for 4 years, but I still want to learn about it." And that's not good.
It makes me think of, this is a little bit of digression, Tom, but it makes me think of Nietzsche, who said if you always look into the abyss, you're going to be depressed.
Well, that's true. So. No, we can find, I think, some uplifting things to say.
Well, on the course of the hour, we'll figure out what those are.
All right.
But the heart of your story, I love the way it begins. You're talking to David Brinker.
Yeah.
Who is a Department of Natural Resources scientist and looking at the Eastern Shore and what's been going on with global warming. And he says to you, you realize Dorchester, that's Dorchester County, in the Eastern Shore, you realize Dorchester's toast.
Well, exactly. And it was shocking
that's
to me because,
term, right?
Because I'd been talking to Brinker about some nitty-gritty stuff like a particular habitat for a particular bird nesting in a particular spot of Dorchester. And then he says, well, you understand that the whole place is toast, right? And And, of course, he's talking over the next several decades, but still, we're not talking the next several centuries. But, yeah, you know, Dorchester, if you look at all the latest assessments of Maryland's vulnerability to climate change and sea level rise, it's going to lose 80,000, 90,000 acres of wetlands and forest. And that's huge. That's 85,000 acres of a 338,000 acre county is pretty certainly going to be gone, as in shallow water, underwater, no longer there. And that's by the end of this century, maybe sooner.
And just describe, I'm taking a little tour around here, but let's just describe where Dorchester is and what is Dorchester. When you say that's going to be, that could be gone, what is gone? What is going to be gone that we know about now?
You know, Dorchester, of course, is Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. It's a lot of the bay's islands. It's 40% of the Chesapeake Bay's tidal wetlands. It's unique. Some people have called it Maryland's Everglades. Technically, it's not an Everglades, but it is. There's really nothing even on the Eastern Shore like Dorchester County. I talk about the upper shore, Talbot on up to Kent and Cecil, and I talk about the lower shore, Wicomico down to Somerset and Worcester. And then Dorchester is uncategorizable. It's just Dorchester County. It's just these vast marshscapes and lonely winding rivers and just amazing numbers of birds and critters. And that's what's going. That's what we're losing. It's low-lying.
It's low-lying.
Yeah, it's ground zero in my mind in the sea level rise. You know, we're warming the climate. It's causing the seas to expand and the ice caps to melt, and the sea level is rising. And pretty much the consensus of scientists is that we can expect about a meter, a little more than 3 feet, by the end of this century. Well, that's big in Dorchester, where a lot of it is already pretty soggy.
That's a lot. Now, yeah. I'm curious, you didn't write about this in the article, but when you talk to these scientists and other folks, what they say about the rest of the Bay Area, you know, I mean, we have on the western part of the shore, I mean, let's even in the Baltimore area, you know, get Cherry Hill and Dundalk and all these places that are right on the water.
Yeah. And, you know, they're not as low as Dorchester, but where you're really going to get bit hard by an extra few feet of sea level there is when we have, as we will, another Isabel. Isabel was
the hurricane.
The hurricane in, I think, 2003. It pushed the water up, storm surge, in the Baltimore-Annapolis area,
right.
8 feet above normal high tide. Isabel happens in 60 years. It's going to be 11 feet above normal high tide. Tremendous impacts. I mean, I think before the end of the century, Baltimore will be actively planning and seeing if it can afford things like tide gates, much like London has on the Thames, to deal with these kinds of surges, because you're talking about billions of dollars in property at risk. So in other cities around the world, Venice, Belfast,
as in Ireland.
Either doing those or looking at them. It's going to be a reality.
That's as part of this whole. I remember talking to Mark. Mark Hertzkar's book, Hot. When you walked in, the one of the things in that book they talk about is the battle among environmentalists, people who care about this global warming, which many people, not just scientists and environmentalists, but that what you're talking about is adaptability to what is coming.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, we can't just worry about adaptability because then we're going to give into it. But there's a certain reality here.
Yeah. I mean, it's a two-pronged approach. I mean, one, we definitely are into adapting, because we have already heated up the oceans enough that if we stopped all carbon burning, ended the fossil fuel economy tomorrow, this is like setting a giant flywheel in motion. You can stop cranking, and that thing's going to turn for, in the case of sea level rise, centuries, no matter what we do. Now, if we do nothing, then we could get into, beyond this century, some truly runaway nightmare scenarios, ice shelf sliding in Greenland or Antarctica, and fairly instantaneous big-time sea level rises that would, you know, literally be a notch below an asteroid hitting the Earth. So, you know, there's ample reason to not just say, okay, we'll adapt and not do anything. But yeah, in the coming decades, we are most definitely into adaptation. We got to stop developing in the coastal zones in most places.
Well, what you just said,
you just don't want to put a lot of expensive infrastructure, you know, sewage treatment plants, nuclear power plants, things like that, where, you know, you can reasonably expect them to be flooded or under threat of storm surge.
But what you're describing here in some ways is an anathema to most people who deal with what they call the real, quote-unquote, realpolitik of the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just, oh, you can't develop here, you can't put this there, you've got to put the forest here, you can't, I mean, it's something that people have a difficult time coming to grips with.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem real, because what's going to be different next year than this year? Not much. What's going to be different 10 years from now? Not a lot, as far as we can foretell. You know, when you build roads and sewage treatment lines, things like that, these are 40, 50, 60 year or longer lifespans of these things. You know, when you put up a subdivision somewhere, I mean, that's not like a garden where you can pull up stakes easily. So we do need to think down the pike decades and maybe even on a century scale. And in fact, you know, Maryland and a lot of other states are doing it. DNR, Maryland Department of Natural Resources, has an Office of Sustainability. They're already advising counties with mixed success to start planning for, you know, 3-4 feet of sea level rise, to adopt building codes that would add an extra couple feet of elevation to anything built within so much of a distance of the coasts. And, you know, so we know what we need to do and are even trying to do it.
But I mean, but it, on, in the same token, and I want to get back to the heart of the article here, but that is that when Governor Martin O'Malley, and I have some issues along the way here as well with even his administration, but Governor Martin O'Malley wants to have a bill around septic tanks, which is really tantamount to saying, no, you got to stop building this way.
Yeah.
And how that affects the environment and where we're going. And the reality is that the political powers to be don't even want to go that far.
Oh, I know. You do. You think about how do we tell people don't develop anymore in all of the low-lying coastal regions when we can't even get new buildings to use better septic tank technology, which is an easy thing to do. We are doing it a little bit in some parts of the bay, but yeah, I know what you mean. How do you talk about that? I don't know any. You know, we're not going to pass a bill next session that takes care of all of our sea level concerns, but you know, there is a conversation. I've heard Nancy Kopp on the Board of Public Works voice concerns about it. I think her son is a scientist who deals with this sort of stuff. So, you know, people who are looking at the finances, the economic future, are aware of this and concerned about it.
So, Tom, we're talking about Tom Horton, by the way. This is one of our Urbanite Radio stories. It's our Earth Day show. It's on Delmarva. It's all of our shows wrapped into one today with Tom Horton. Who also you can hear on our Ondo Marva series, doing commentary every other week. This week's a bit more than a commentary. It's a long commentary. And it's the Urbanite article that Tom wrote. And the Urbanite article is entitled "The Bay Comes Calling." As the impacts of climate change play out, we find ourselves with a greater hand in shaping the Chesapeake and ever more at its mercy. Let me, one thing before I ask you to describe a couple things in the article. There are a lot of people who look at what's going on in our environment, and they go, well, look, you know, the planet goes through cycles, and it does.
Yeah.
Historically, there's warming and cooling trends, ice ages, and
yeah,
all that takes place in the life and breath of our planet from the beginning of the planet when it was first created and on, or created itself and on. So, but what you're saying, and seeing other scientists and other people are saying, is that we may be having that now, but our industrial revolution, as you quote, what's his name, Arrhenius?
Arrhenius.
Arrhenius.
Yeah.
In the
1990s,
saying
we were 1896, you know, he could see then that we were likely to cause this so-called greenhouse effect by burning coal at the time, putting more carbon in the atmosphere, trapping more of the sun's reflected heat, et cetera. You know, he didn't foresee, I don't think, 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100 in Norfolk, it's not a new idea.
So I mean, but what we're saying is that that the industrialization of the planet is exacerbating the natural cycles of the Earth.
Yeah, there's all sorts of natural cycles on terms from years to decades to these Milankovitch cycles, which have to do with the Earth's oscillations, wobbles as it goes around the sun. And those are like 250,000 year cycles. And I think we're in the early stages of a Milankovitch cycle that may actually mitigate climate change, but we're talking that's way out. That's quarter million year stuff. But yeah, there are all these cycles,
right.
And you can certainly talk about natural cycles. On the other hand, you know, we've got more carbon dioxide, the main culprit in warming and sea level rise. We've got more of that in the atmosphere than there has been in 650,000 years, and increasing pretty rapidly. And it's you can debate the finer points of exactly how much of this is due to human activity. But to say it's not due to human activity with close to 7 billion people burning lots of fossil fuels all over the planet is but frankly, let's say you didn't believe humans had anything to do with it.
Right.
You still got sea level coming up. You could think it was because we've got too many elephants, whatever. Or as someone once put it, it's the weight of all those old National Geographics that are causing the continents to sink. You could think anything. You still got to deal with rising sea level. And to say that's not real is flat earth stuff.
Well, one of the things that's following up on one of the quotes you have in here from Donald Bosch, who's the director of the University of Maryland's Environmental Research Centers, he said, even if we could stop heating the planet on a dime, as you talked about earlier,
yeah,
substantial changes are going to occur. And so now there's more conversation about how to adapt, which is what we talked a bit about a minute ago.
And Bosch is keenly aware of that because he has made his career on the Chesapeake, and he is from Louisiana. So he knows low-lying lands. He knows Katrina. He knows about sea level rise like few people do. And,
So talk a bit about your article is really really interesting. I mean, to me, because it a number of people in the article I've interviewed before, but you put these things in a certain way, and I think that just for people to put their hands around it, you have the piece in this article where you talk about how hotter air creates hotter water. What it does for it, you talked about Isabel earlier ago. What all that? How, tie that together for us scientifically. What are we saying here?
Well, first let's dispel one thing. There have been, perhaps people, well-intentioned people, who would like to get even more action to do something about climate change, who have sort of indicated that hotter air, hotter water is going to mean more hurricanes. To my knowledge, there is no evidence that the climate change we're embarked on is going to cause more hurricanes. It may, but we can't prove that. However, what is very clear, it's just a simple matter of physics, is it's going to cause bigger, badder, more destructive hurricanes.
That's
because
the point.
Hurricanes are heat engines. They draw their energy from the water. And if the water's hotter, the hurricane gets bigger. So really... storms like Isabel, which cause these huge surges in the bay, are pretty rare. We've only had two in the last 100 years, one in 1933, the big August storm that created the inlet at Ocean City, and Isabel. There are storms that track west of the bay, which causes a particularly large and destructive storm surge. Will we see more of those Isabel 33 storms? Can't say. Will they be worse, even worse than 8 feet of sea level rise on top of normal high tide? Yeah, definitely.
So,
and we will, we will have them. The only news would be if we were never going to have another Isabel. But we will.
We will have
Japan them. Will have another tsunami. These things happen. They're natural occurrences.
And you see it now. I mean, you have that great picture at the top of the article of the house that's
the old house on Holland Island.
Holland Island.
That's one that's gotten a lot of publicity. The old house fell in. It was the kind of iconic remnant of a thriving community of 400 or 500 people that lived on Holland Island for centuries and had to abandon it because of erosion, sea level rise, starting about 1910. And that one house has sat out there. The family whose relatives owned that house, the Todds in Crisfield, they go out there frequently. They've brought back some of the family gravestones before they could go under. And, I.T. Todd, who's in his 90s, was one of the last babies born on that island. And, I've talked to his son Casey, and he's very conscious that they moved because of the Chesapeake coming calling out on Holland, his family, and they got a seafood plant on the water in Crisfield, and he can see the water coming up there and says, we probably have to move again at some point. The bay just keeps coming. They're very conscious of that.
We're so conscious about all that stuff, but it's how you translate that consciousness into something more than just being aware of it.
Well, one of the things that Don Baugh, a friend of mine who is in charge of education for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, they make the point with kids that, look, an awful lot of what you want to do if you worry about sea level rise, climate change, is exactly what you want to do if you're trying to clean up, restore water quality in the bay. And that's because the bay's principal pollutant, nitrogen, comes from burning fossil fuels. It comes from heating and cooling our homes. It comes from driving automobiles. Same source of carbon dioxide. So if we had never heard of climate change, working very zealously to clean up very well documented problems with nitrogen polluting the bay, killing the underwater grasses, depressing oxygen levels, that would achieve the same thing. So there's this nice overlap between things that we are already working on. We're not doing nearly enough, by the way, but you kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. The other things where there's overlap is you cut trees for a new parking lot. You've just cut down something that absorbs not only a lot of nitrogen before it gets in the bay, it absorbs a lot of carbon before it gets into the atmosphere. So again, energy efficiency, burn less fossil fuels, go to renewable energies, protect forests, wetlands, other natural systems that sequester carbon and nitrogen, big overlaps. And I find that very hopeful.
I mean, Jerry Weingart.
Weingart, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who, former state senator.
Right.
Now, when I talk with him, it's been a while, he's a bulldog when it comes to things.
Yes, he is.
He's a bulldog. And he believes in nuclear power and that's the way we need to go.
Yeah.
The other part of him also says, he screams from the rooftops. Not many people are listening. He said, no, don't cut down another forest. Don't cut down another. We have to stop. We have to reforest our land, live in the urban centers, and stop cutting things down if we're going to survive as a people.
It's true. Replanting, restoring, increasing forests is one of the best ways you can go to clean up the bay, also to keep carbon from building up in the atmosphere. Plus, look at all the other benefits. I mean, who doesn't like forests? Trees are pretty. Trees cool our houses, shade our streets. They provide good hunting opportunities. You show me a stream with a forest around it, I'll show you good fishing. We like to hike in them. I mean, you just can't beat it. Yeah, I think if you told me I could only do one thing to restore the Chesapeake Bay, it would probably be increase forest in the watershed throughout the six states. And it would do a lot to mitigate climate change, too.
And as we wind our way back to the heart of your article, I'm just going to take a little circuitous route here to get back to what you were writing about.
No, I vote for trees, yeah.
is that we talk about nitrogen and phosphorus, and we are making headway, but it's also in sometimes in fits and starts, and it's in, making compromises, and you build a put grass here to keep to soak it up and not let it go into the water. But it's more than that. We're facing, this is, and it's not just the farms either. I mean, it's all this stuff that the suburbanites want to dump on their lawns to have a green lawn. I mean, it's.
I thought we were trying to be uplifting here, Mark.
Could be. I mean, you can. So I'm anti-grass. I hate mowing lawns. I think it's a bloody waste of time.
We could do a show on that. I've wiped out three lawns and I'm working on a fourth.
Good for you, man.
And I'm proud of it.
I want to learn how to do that from you. I want to wipe out the entire lawn that we have. I can't stand it. But
start by never raking a leaf.
Start by never raking a leaf. I can do that.
Yeah, it's look, not doing anything is a very hard thing for Americans to do.
Right.
Just having trees and letting the leaves fall and not raking or burning, that's tough for people. Not for me, but anyway, I'm not typical. We can wipe out grass. That would be an uplifting thing to do. But you're right. I mean, we're not doing anywhere near what we need to do, whether it's cleaning up the bay or doing something about carbon and climate change. Nowhere near.
When you say uplifting, I was thinking that, I think it's uplifting for on any man or woman who has to mow their lawn every Saturday, Sunday to say, we're going to free you from having to mow your lawn ever again. You're free to go shopping, to hang out with your kids, to go to the park, to go sailing, to ride a bike. You don't have to worry about it anymore.
It's like Nancy Reagan, just say no to drugs. I just say no to raking. It's as simple as that,
I'm completely with this. I like this. Listen, she's writing here at steiner@gmail.com, and let us know if you agree with that. I want to know if you just stop this raking business and lawns. Yep. But in all seriousness, what I'm saying here, because that's the uplifting side of it, is that the other part is that if we don't kind of address those things, though, I mean, in a very serious way, then we're not going to be able to tackle the issue of global warming and destroying what we have here.
Yeah, it's pretty clear to restore the bay and probably to mitigate global warming, you have to worry about not only what comes out of pipes and smokestacks and exhausts, you have to leave in place the natural features of the landscape around the earth that if just left to themselves, help cleanse things. They're like gills or kidneys or filters, whatever you want to call them. Forests are absorbing huge amounts of the carbon that goes in the atmosphere. I mean, if all the carbon, the CO2 that we were putting into the atmosphere actually were contributing to global warming, we'd be gone a long time ago. You know, there are these big sinks. The forests are taking up a lot. The oceans are taking up a lot. And those are where some of the real uncertainties lie in sorting out the future of climate change and sea level rises is how much are these sinks actually absorbing and how long will they continue to absorb? You know, we pretty much know they're not unlimited. The oceans at some point begin to release carbon, but those are big scientific questions, and a lot of the arguments and uncertainties you find are, you know, we know what we're putting in. We just don't know where it's all going.
And right, exactly. We're talking with Tom Horton. Tom Horton's this is one of our Urbanite Radio stories. Tom Horton has written a really fascinating, pretty lengthy piece, and easy to read, called "The Bay Comes Calling." As the impacts of climate change play out, we find ourselves with a greater hand in shaping the Chesapeake, and ever more at its mercy. Tom, of course, is the environmental writer for The Sun for many, 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 many moons, author of a great many books. And joins us here for our Urbanite Radio Stories for On Delmarva as we talk about Earth Day and our state of Maryland and what we can expect and what we can do. So we'll take a very short break and come right back with Tom Horton. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Tom Horton in our series Urbanite Radio Stories. He wrote an incredibly wonderful piece in this month's Urbanite called "The Bay Comes Calling." Tom, of course, can be heard on Delmarva. You're listening to as well every other week with his commentaries. This is just maybe like one of his gigantic commentaries because it's going to go on for the show as we celebrate and talk about Earth Day. And Tom. And by the way, your commentaries are really well received. People like them a great deal. We had a lot of response from your commentaries.
Oh, that's great.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But let's write about the Chesapeake. You also take us on a journey down to Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah. In my mind, around the Chesapeake region, there's two ground zeros in sea level rise where you can – it's happening now. One is – the rural one is Dorchester County, which we've talked about with all its marshes and low-lying forests at risk. But – Norfolk has probably the fastest rate of sea level rise anywhere in the Chesapeake, and that's a twofold thing. It's not just the water coming up. It's that the land all around the bay is sinking, and that has to do with the retreat of the glaciers 10,000 years ago. The land is still settling back from having been bulged up, and it's sinking all around the bay, but as you move south along the bay, it sinks faster, and you get down to Norfolk. So the effective rate at which the water's coming up in Norfolk is one of the highest places anywhere in the country. Hmm. And they just spent $1.5 million in the last year or two to help residents of six homes,
six houses.
Sea level rise. These guys, twice a month on the high tides, the spring tides, these guys were having to park a couple blocks away. You know, that gets to be a pain in the butt twice a month. Your car gets salt water. So, you know, they did storm drain work, street work, and all of this is just a stopgap. And for 6 years, you know, you can't do that. They've even hired a Dutch firm. You know, the Dutch know a lot about holding the sea back, and they are advising Norfolk. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch Norfolk, how they deal with this. And there are, you can find people with means in Norfolk who have basically constructed a wall around their home. And, you know, it'll work for a while, but everybody can't do that. And it also has the effect of sending the water to the next guy down who doesn't have a wall around
right.
his home. So, yeah, Norfolk is an area that is dealing with this. And, you know, the big Northrop Grumman shipbuilding facility down there.
It was in Newport. It was in Norfolk.
Yeah, exactly. When they, I didn't realize this, when they start on a big Navy craft, like an aircraft carrier, they have this thing in a dry dock for 6 years. That's how long it takes. And they're very vulnerable to storm surges. So they're very concerned about, because they're you know, if they get another Isabel while they've got a big aircraft carrier under construction there, can't move the thing, can't float yet. And it could be that, you know, what's going to drive our response to climate change is just plain old economics, property rights, worried about your property, worried about your industry, you know, because a lot of it's located around the coastal edges.
But it calls for kind of a commitment, and that commitment is also financial. I mean, it's also changing, and we're talking about cutting budgets down to the bone, but we're talking about how to create some adaptability so we can survive this.
Yeah, and it's not just Norfolk. I mean, you know, given the prospects for sea level rise to be a meter or more higher by the end of this century, should we have a policy to encourage more growth and building in the ocean cities and the Rehoboths and
right.
the Bethanies?
Exactly.
Is that wise policy? In the very short term, sounds good, but in the longer term. And, you know, some areas, North Carolina, Texas, are trying to deal with this in the form of, they're sometimes called rolling easements, and they are aimed at property owners around the coastal edges, you know, agree that as sea level rise comes up, to retreat in their building or to give easements once sea level rise starts coming in to make that public property and undeveloped. It's basically saying this land that now looks buildable isn't always going to be buildable. In fact, it could be a disaster to build there, so we're going to acknowledge that and take it out of the development.
I mean, there's a lot of people who think, pretty radically speaking, that you should have, we shouldn't have houses on the ocean. We shouldn't have houses that close to the water, period.
Well, it's a real risk. I mean, I would go so far as to say I don't think any public money should be spent. You know, right now about 75%, I think, of the millions that we spend every year pumping up new sand on the beaches along the Maryland, Delaware, Virginia coasts comes from the feds.
Right.
Comes from taxpayers all over America. It would be very interesting to see the rethinking of coastal development if Worcester County, Ocean City, the state of Maryland had to foot the whole bill. My guess is you'd see some very different thinking if we were paying for it. And I think that's maybe something that ought to happen. If it doesn't happen, if the feds keep picking up the tab, then why not?
It'd be interesting. That'd be an interesting conversation to have. But you talk about in here Wetlands Watch and the Army Corps of Engineers around this whole issue and the differences.
Well, Wetlands Watch is a nonprofit down in the Norfolk area. Yeah, a guy named Skip Stiles, who has a lot of congressional experience with environmental issues, runs it. And they are encouraging. They're very concerned, among other things, about the tendency of property owners to put stone or bulkheading out there to protect their property from erosion, which gets worse as sea level comes up. What that really does is it ensures that any wetlands are going to be extinguished, because wetlands can't survive where you've armored the shoreline with rock or with steel. And, you know, long term, One of the options we do have is if we keep the shoreline natural as the current wetlands are submerged, new wetlands can form inland.
Emerge.
But they can't if you got a big rock wall there or a sheet steel bulkhead. So, you know, there's this natural tendency of property owners, usually subsidized with low-interest loans from the states, as they see their shoreline eroding, to put a big rock wall there.
Mm-hmm.
In the long term, that's a great way to ensure that we'll not only lose our wetlands, we'll never gain any others. And it's a complicated problem. There are some ways to protect shorelines without just sealing them off. We can put some offshore breakwaters out there, leave gaps for water to get through. But you almost have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. But, yeah, Wetlands Watch is beginning to challenge these almost automatically given Corps of Engineers permits when someone wants to plunk down a lot of rock or armor
but
their
it
shoreline.
It happens all the time. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. Reading your article, I was thinking about a friend of mine who I go visit. They have a place down in Delaware by the beach.
Yeah,
it's a place where all these townhouses were built. You know, on the spot, and they're great people. They're environmentally conscious. They're politically involved. They do healthy things. They try to live their life the right way. They're really a wonderful couple.
Yeah,
they're one of my closest friends. But then we were sitting there one day, and I walked around their complex, and I started thinking because they had this little bridge. You walk over this little bridge. And had this bridge where they had signs about the animals that live there in these little wetlands. And then I walked back across the bridge, turned around, looked out again over the marsh. And the ocean was back, I guess, to my back, a little ways. I looked at the marsh, and I went, wait a minute. This development, with all these hundreds of houses on it, a stone's throw away from the ocean, across the highway, is built on a marsh. It's built on wetlands. What I'm standing on in this concrete under here were wetlands, and someone said, yes, you can build on these wetlands, tear them up, and put up these townhouses.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, you go to Ocean City, chances are on the bayside you're standing on former wetlands. And,
okay. So if we thought about the role the wetlands play, just in terms of the natural rhythms of the earth and cleaning the bay as a place for crabs and fish to lay their eggs and grow and become the creatures that we want to eat and fish and all that. If you think about all that and just the natural role that wetlands play, then if we really built around and lived in a way that didn't destroy any more wetlands, it would really change our lifestyle. We'd have to change the way we live. And that, to me, that's not a negative thing. This is not an old doom and gloom. This is what it could – think about what it could be.
Yeah, well, here's a twist on that, Mark. I mean, by and large, states like Maryland, Virginia have done a pretty good job of stopping the filling of these tidal wetlands. It happens, but it happens in very small amounts and done a pretty good job there. But if you look at the wetlands, so we lose to filling and development, you know, wetlands measured in the acres or maybe tens of acres a year around the bay. That's pretty good. Meanwhile, sea level rise looks like it's going to take out over the next several decades tens of thousands of acres of wetlands. So here we are. It's a curious situation because what am I saying? Certainly not repeal the wetlands laws. Here we are fighting these sometimes intense legal battles over whether a developer can fill an eighth of an acre or a 16th of an acre or a 32nd of an acre. And our lifestyles, which lead to climate change, are, even as we fight those battles, going to wipe out tens of thousands of acres. It's just one of those ironies. I don't really know where to go with that, except to say we it's going to take more than a good wetlands law to protect wetlands these days. It's going to take dealing with climate change, which is to say dealing with the way we live.
And even there, I was thinking that I had these programs recently. A little bit of digression from your article, but I know you don't mind.
No.
I've had a lot of shows recently about. Thinking about this Earth Day, about wind power versus no wind power.
Yeah.
And so I've had a number of people send me articles, read these articles about the problems with wind power. And one of the things you start reading about, I mean, when you think about people arguing the unknown about what wind power does to the ocean and the ocean floor and the things live there. Once you put these gigantic things there, then how do you get that energy from here to there? And what does that energy do to change the rhythm of the earth when you suck it into energy forms? And you look at solar energy and the kind of way those panels are made, the limited amount of rare earth materials that actually exist to make those solar panels that we could run out of in 30 years, like we could run out of oil in 60 years. So you begin to ponder, okay, then what do we do? How do we begin to really wrestle with what the future is going to bring us given what we've already done? I mean, to really kind of think among ourselves about how you build an energy system that doesn't pollute the earth, and how do we do these things given all the kind of problems that come even with the alternative energy systems that we want?
Well, I think I personally come back more and more to the question of how many of us can live on this planet in a truly sustainable manner. You know, you can take a piece of paper and imagine everything from space colonies to technologies that don't now exist that might enable 10 billion of us to live a whole lot greener than 6.5 or 7 billion do now, but that's faith-based stuff, you know, I mean, and beyond. I think your point is that as our numbers increase, even if we live greener, maybe even a lot greener, we still have unacceptable impacts if we're looking for sustainability, which is to say a truce with the rest of nature, coexistence, not just coexistence, but restoration of a lot that we've almost lost. So, you know, we do have to look at the numbers of us, and that's a whole nother show, you know, and no one wants to do that much, even in the environmental movement, but I think it's essential. Meanwhile, we surely, those of us who are here and yet to come, can do a lot better than we have, but I don't know if 9 or 10 billion can live sustainably on the planet. I certainly not. With anything we know how to do today or are likely to do.
Population is a major part of the issue. We talked about Paul Ehrlich was on the show but a few weeks ago, who kind of sounded this alarm to us 40-some years ago or more with his book, The Population Bomb.
Yeah. So and it's, you know, people tend to look at that in terms of can we feed ourselves, can we house ourselves? And I think the answer is sure we can. You know, I don't worry about running out of food, but we might have to change our diet. But can we really have a beautiful, diverse nature across the planet with that many people? I think that's really probably not.
Well, so when we think about this, and I was a conversation that we had earlier this week with Rabbi Arthur Waskow, and he looks at the earth and the spiritual aspects of what we have to do, and he thinks about that connection we have with the earth. And I thought about it, you know, you're trying to look at it in a positive sense, in kind of a how we you kind of look at this joyously in an uplifting way. It might sound silly, but I mean, how we think about how we can survive and what we have to do. We always seem to make it onerous. It doesn't have to be onerous. It might change the way we think and feel and act and live, but it doesn't have to be onerous.
Well, I would agree with that. You know, we environmentalists all have this fault that we are trying to tell you how horrible it's going to be if you don't do something.
Right.
And you know, we may be right, but that's probably the wrong way to recruit the troops. And we need to do a better job at being uplifting, for lack of a better word. I don't think that means glossing over the problems or say there, we don't have to worry, everything will all settle out and achieve some natural balance. Partly it's going to be defining what we want. Do we really, really want, can we really, really have a Chesapeake Bay pretty much like the one you and I grew up with? Maybe not. Doesn't mean we can't have a very high-quality existence, including a lot of outdoor nature stuff around the bay, but maybe we're going to decide we can't have oyster communities resembling those that, you know, drove the bay's ecosystem, cleansed the waters 150 years ago.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. We can raise plenty of oysters to eat. We can have some wonderful sanctuaries that will be remnants of that oyster community, much like they've got remnants of the tall grass prairies out in Oklahoma and Illinois and Nebraska, and people come from all over to see them. They're not going to get the whole tall grass prairie back because they'd have to move Chicago, but, part of it may be getting a little more realistic about things like that.
As you were saying that, I was thinking that when we did a program on Delmarva, or for our program on Delmarva, with the Choptank Sweet Oyster Company, I learned something that day. Yeah. I had no idea. I mean, things were unfolding for me as I produced these series, and
they got a good oyster. I've had them.
They have a good. Yeah. They make a good oyster.
Yeah.
And what I realized was that even the oysters we have in the bay are seeded by scientists who grow the spawn. The spat.
Yeah.
They grow the spat and they lay them in there. Yeah. So even the oysters that we glean from the bay are raised by somebody else and then dumped in the bay. And that maybe we do have to think in things change, occupations change, life ways change.
Yeah.
As much as it's hard for us to want to deal with that. So maybe things do have to change in ways that allow us to survive and eat and do what we want, but we have to do it in a different way. And in that way, restore the bay and kind of do things in ways we're not thinking. It's not always as simple as kind of holding on to the past, but we can't hold on to the past.
Well, it gets harder and harder to go back.
Because you write about the past a lot, and I think about that when you're writing.
Yeah, and, you know, this sea level rise we're talking about is a good example. You know, even if we do everything right with renewable energy and then some, we are going to be dealing with sea level rise, loss of existing islands, marshlands, low-lying forests for centuries to come. That is a given. The only question is how we're going to deal with it.
Right.
Are we going to fight it with stone and rock and steel and tide gates? Are we going to plan to just retreat back from the edges, live more densely, compactly, stop this sprawl development? Those are big decisions to be made. And, it doesn't mean you can't have a very high quality of life. It'll be different.
It does have to be different. I mean, in terms of what we use our land to grow, and how we do that and how we transport the stuff. I mean, it seems to me that that what you said earlier is interesting when you think about Earth Day in the future, because Earth Day, you know, when it started, it was the beginning of, oh, woe's me, what's happening to our planet.
Yeah.
But to start describing the future as something we can create.
Well, I mean, here's a simple little example. Let's say we've got 10 acres of land.
Right.
And I got to feed you.
Right.
And you want a lot of burgers, a lot of steak, a lot of pork. Well, I'm going to have to use most of that 10 acres, take it out of forest. Maybe I can leave an acre or two to feed you all that meat. Now, let's say I can convince you to eat tofu and maybe some other delicious veggie treats. And I tell you, here's the trade-off. You like to walk in the woods. You like to sequester a little carbon. You'd like to watch the leaves build up. If you're willing to eat veggie, we can keep about 7 or 8 acres in forest, and I'll only need a couple to feed you. That's a simple thing, but the fact is, if you're going to get your protein from steak, you're going to have to use a lot more of your very finite land base to do it. Whereas if you just eat, like a lot of critters, directly from the plant community, you can use that land for other things. And maybe you'll decide, I like steak better than forest. I like forest better than steak, you know. But these are the sort of decisions you're talking about. And when you make them societally, if the Chinese decide, as they are deciding right now, they want more and more and more pork, well, that's tough with a billion plus. That's a lot of pork, that's a lot of grain, that's a lot of land that can't be in forest, can't be in anything. But
they're the ones who gave us tofu.
Yeah, I know. So these are huge decisions. I frankly, we've talked about this before, I don't think environmental groups educate people enough and lobby enough around this diet-environment connection because just to give you an example, Marina Blecken, who's a Norwegian nutritionist, food economist, has done some calculations. If we were to not go totally veggie, but just do what she calls a Mediterranean diet. Some meat, but more.
Diet.
Yeah, it's a good diet. More meats, more pastas, grains, cereals. We could probably cut agricultural runoff because we'd have to use less farmland, less fertilizer. We could cut it by about what we think we need to cut it to restore Chesapeake Bay. So that's a decision that is a thinkable decision. It's not like saying you'd have to eat, you know, green peas and nothing else the rest of your life. You know, a Mediterranean diet, that's a very thinkable change, even for the meat-eating American culture, because it's not meatless. And that can make a huge difference in the uses to which we can put the land vis-a-vis intensive agriculture, more nature, better water quality. These are great areas that are way under-discussed, under-analyzed.
No, and so, and one of the things I was thinking about in terms of that is this article you wrote, and also you always have this kind of vein of thought running through your work, which is that it's not all hopeless. This is what we face, but we can find ways around this to kind of survive. I mean, you're looking at it as a practical environment, a practical radical, or practical whatever.
Here's a funny thing. I was walking to lunch in Lauraville the other day with Heather Dewar, a good friend who succeeded me on the Baltimore Sun, very fine environmental writer.
Good writer.
And we were working ourselves, as usual, into a pretty good depression. And I said, well, Heather, what the heck makes you optimistic? And she said exactly what I have often said. She said, you know, Horton, I just see an abandoned parking lot, how fast the weeds come back up through the cracks in the asphalt, and in a year or two, you hardly see the asphalt. If you let it go for 50 years, you wouldn't even know civilization had been there. I mean, the bottom line being nature is incredibly resilient given half a chance. It will come back. I mean, maybe it won't come back in our lifetime the way we remembered it, the way we like it. You know, to parking lot to an old growth forest, you're talking hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. But you realize nature is this powerful, powerful force.
Yes.
We are too, but so is nature. And it's like you want to wipe out lawn, you don't have to use herbicides, you don't have to plow, just stop raking the leaves, let things come up. Most people wouldn't be content with completely hands-off, because you might get green briar and poison ivy for the first 100 years, and then some nice trees would start to come in.
Right.
So we manage, but I do find that, you know, nature is powerful.
It is powerful, and I think that this is a good way to kind of round this out, because I think that there's, to me, if we do things in certain ways, there's a hopeful way of looking at where we can end up.
Yeah. The other thing is I a lot of the courses I teach at Salisbury University, I go heavy on field trips. I do that for a lot of reasons. I believe in experiential learning. But a lot of it is these kids are hearing from the day they were born how much we've screwed up the environment, and I'm piling it on. But there are a whole lot of really cool places. So, you know, we canoe up to a stand of bald cypress, some of which are 500 years old, right within a couple miles of U.S. 13 near Laurel, Delaware. And we have a little class on forests and old-growth forests right under a 500-year-old cypress tree. They need to see that kind of stuff, that it's still there, that they can go see it anytime they want. It's protected by the state of Delaware now. Similarly, we go up some of the rivers like the Pocomoke and the Nanticoke that have been protected by the Nature Conservancy, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and others, because they need to see these places. These are bona fide great spots, you know, not pristine, not what John Smith saw, but John Smith wouldn't be lost there either if he came back. So he'd recognize things.
Well, the Nanticoke lived there in the first place.
Yeah, so you know, you got to get outside. You got to get them outside. If you can't enjoy the environment, it'll burn you out so quick.
Tom Horton, always great to have you on this program. You've been listening to Tom Horton here on the Mark Steiner Show. This is a combination of our Urbanite radio stories and On Delmarva. Tom wrote "The Bay Comes Calling" in the latest issue of the Urbanite, and Tom is a great environmentalist, great environmental writer and reporter for years in the Sun, and written many books. including Bay Country and Island Out of Time, a memoir, Smith Island and Chesapeake, and is, of course, our regular commentator here on Delmarva. Tom Horton, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.